Tuesday night, December the 25th. This is going to be about, what is our last? Oh, we have one more meeting this month, don't we? This year, I mean. All right. No, that's right, we don't. Next Tuesday is the first, that's right. All right, we got our date straight. Now we're ready to begin with Exodus 13:3, if I remember right. Exodus 13:3. Is that what you have? We had been reading here some instructions about keeping the Passover in chapter 12 and learned that uncircumcised people could have nothing to do with it. And also certain regulations for those who did keep it and who were capable of keeping it. They had to do certain things to be ready for it. And then in chapter 13, is sanctifying to me all the firstborn, whatever openeth the womb among the children of Israel, both the man and the beast, it is mine. Now I might just get a little question right along in there with that. Why, in the record of the birth of Christ, was he presented at the temple? This verse tells you. Firstborn, the Lord says, is mine. And so there was a presentation at the temple. He belonged to the Lord. Now, there are other folks who are like that. There was Samuel. He belonged to the Lord. His mother had even promised he'd be in the Lord's service. But actually, being her firstborn, he did belong to the Lord to start with. And you could go on and on. All right? Now we're ready for the third verse. And Moses said unto the people, and people there's capitalized as it is all the way through here, meaning Israel. And incidentally, when you read in these records here and it says children of Israel, remember that word children actually means sons. They're the sons of Israel. Unfortunately, the translators didn't give the dignity there that was due. Remember this day in which ye came out from Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out from this place. There shall no leavened bread be eaten. Again, warning about the leaven. The Lord also warned about leaven, told his disciples to beware the leaven of the scribes and the Pharisees. And of course they understood him to mean to beware of the teaching there, the scribes and Pharisees. Is used as a figure of speech. For here it is actual, real leaven. A yeast plant which multiplies rapidly, causes fermentation, and by which we usually get our bread to rise so that it's full of little holes and a little easier to eat. Unleavened bread is pretty solid, pretty hard. This day came ye out in the month of Abib. Nisan is another name for it. And it shall be when the Lord shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he sware unto thy fathers, to give thee a land flowing with milk and honey, that thou shalt keep this service in this month. Your note says here, a couple of these heights, these people here, Canaan, the names are left out. We find little things like that happening along. They left out the Perizzites and the Girgashites. But we find even in the names of the 12 tribes, the names of the 12 tribals, or 12 apostles, and so on, that there's an interchange of names at different times to suit certain circumstances and to fit in with certain meanings. And I didn't go into it, didn't try to delve into it as to why these two were left out here. I just took it for granted it was all right and went on. Now, there might be, if we'd get into this historical part here and look a little closer about these two, we might find a reason for them being left out here. Well, at any rate, I know that the word itself is pretty accurate, and there's always a reason for what is done. Verse 6, 7 days thou shalt eat unleavened bread, and the seventh day shall be a feast to the Lord. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles, which occurred in the fall, was an 8-day feast. This was a 7-day feast. And you will find other feasts. Pentecost, for instance, is 1 day. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and there shall no leavened bread be seen with thee, neither shall there be leaven seen with thee in all thy quarters. It is to be cleaned out, as we mentioned last time, that was probably where the spring house cleaning business began. For this time of the Passover, get it every bit cleaned out, so they'd scrape and scratch and dig in all the corners and so on to be sure everything was clean. And thou shalt show thy son in that day, saying, this is done because of that which the Lord did unto me when I came forth out of Egypt. And it shall be for a sign upon unto thee upon thine hand, and for a memorial between thine eyes, that the Lord's law may be in thy mouth. Now, there's some more figure here that we'll get through the sentence. For the strong hand hath the Lord brought thee out of Egypt. They're to remember this so much as if it was written between their eyes and had it written or a sign on their hand. They were to be always conscious of the fact that they'd been delivered, or we would say redeemed, from Egypt. And of course that had a lot of significance to it, besides just a releasing of a bunch of slaves. There was a redemptive work there, which was done by blood, the lamb on the blood of the lamb or kid, whichever it was, on the doorpost and the lintel, and then the strong arm of God doing the actual bringing out of Egypt. So there is redemptive work, and of course this word Exodus is about redemption all the way through. And you will find redemption also in Ephesians and Colossians. So, its redemption is truth for today. Thou shalt therefore keep this ordinance in his season from year to year. And it shall be when the Lord shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanites, as he sware unto thee and to thy fathers, and shall give it thee, that thou shalt set apart unto the Lord all that openeth the matrix, and every firstling that cometh of the beast which thou hast. The male shall be the Lord's. Now here we do have a little specification. We have been a little bit in the dark before as to whether the first one, the firstborn, was could be a female or whether or not. But now it's specific. You see, if you read far enough, you'll finally get your answers, your questions answered. And so here then it is the males, not the females. And every firstling, verse 13, of an ass, and here this is used for any unclean beast that they might have. That include a camel and a horse, any of the unclean beasts. Remember, clean beasts were beasts who had the cloven hoof and chewed the cud. Now, a hog has a cloven hoof. It doesn't chew the cud. The rabbit chews a cud, but doesn't have a cloven hoof. And the camel chews a cud, but he doesn't have a cloven hoof. He has pads, two of them, for feet, just two toes, pads. Well, that sort of narrows it down then, the what are clean and unclean. Chewing the cud and having a cloven hoof, that is, a hoof of two pieces. Now, a horse has a single hoof. It isn't cloven or split. Maybe you didn't know that old word. So it's a split hoof. We have to watch our old English. You see, it can cleave wood. That means to split wood. I do that sometimes. Well, now here, verse 13 again. And every firstling of an ass or an unclean beast thou shalt redeem with a lamb. That is, give the Lord a lamb for it. And if thou wilt not redeem it, then thou shalt break his neck. Well, that was a way of mercifully killing an animal, a very quick and effective way. Just breaking his neck. Now, I used to do some hunting and trapping. I learned to do that with some animals, too, that you didn't know when they're dead or not. If you break their neck, then you're sure. They aren't going to come to and bite you. But I do want you to note that in all of the narratives of the Old Testament, the laws are given to Israel and the customs and so on, that there is this humane idea going all the way through. Now, God was merciful to animals as well as he was to people. And all the firstborn of man among thy children shalt thou redeem. Now, the redemption money, as you find in the law later on, we'll get to that, a half shekel of silver. That's redemption money. And that was collected and cast into big bases or sockets for to set the boards of the tabernacle in. Each one of those sockets weighing around 100 pounds. So the foundation of the whole thing was, you see, redemption. As again I said, this Exodus is about redemption. So we have something about that in Exodus. Verse 14. And it shall be, when thy son asketh thee in time to come, saying, what is this? What are we doing? What is this feast that we're having? That thou shalt say unto him, by strength of hand the Lord brought us out from Egypt and from the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh would hardly let us go, that the Lord slew all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all that openeth the matrix, being males, but all the firstborn of my children I redeem. Well, that's the end of that quote, what he's to say. And among the Israelites, we know from history that when they observed the Passover, that the youngest child would be able to ask the question in the household, would ask the question here, as it's given here, what is this, or why do we do this, or whatever the question they would, way they'd ask it. And because they wanted their children to learn the scriptures very early age, because they knew from Deuteronomy 8:3 that man doth not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth from the mouth of God doth man live. So they want those children to have life and have a resurrection and to get it just as early as they possibly can in case, you know, of accidental death or something. And now, verse 16. And it. Well, we talked about this a little bit a while ago in another verse here. It shall be a token on thine hand for frontlets between thine eyes. That is a constant remembrance of their redemption. For by strength of hand the Lord brought us forth out of Egypt. And it came to pass, now we're getting into the story again, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war, when they return. They weren't ready yet for war. They weren't well enough organized yet for that. And there would have been some difficulty probably too, because they'd have had to have found some way of getting through that great wall ashore. And the the Fort Migdol was at the entrance there of that, and the Mediterranean. And there have been many difficulties with that, but I think this main one is all the reason it's needed. And that is that the very first thing would hit when they go out would be the Amalekites, because they'd settled in that part of the country. Well, they did hit the Amalekites as soon as they went out of Egypt, it would soon follow, but not like they would have in that place. They were just a little further on, farther south and a little east where they did cross. And remember now that with all their flocks and their herds and so on they left Egypt with, that it said that it was 11 days' journey to Canaan. Just keep that in mind. And Israel took 40 years to make it. 11 days' journey. That's pretty slow, isn't it? They talk about the old story of the rabbit and the turtle, the race. Israel must have been the turtle. Well, they got there anyhow, by and by. But God led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up harnessed out of the land of Egypt. Now, when I was a youngster, when they talked about being harnessed, well, that was those contraptions of straps and buckles and so on to put on the horses, you know, so they could work them, get them to pull something. Well, it's called that harness. But back in the medieval days, a man's armor was his harness. And so even in 1611, it was not out of the way at all for the translators to say harness. And good idea for us to remember those words, because we have the harness that we're to put on, you know, in Ephesians 6, six parts of the harness. Now, I used to be able to tell you just every part of the harness it was. We put on the workhorses. I don't know whether I can do that now or not. It's been a long time since I've handled that. But I did know all of the parts. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. Oh, they remembered Joseph. Now, Joseph had died about 150 years before this, before they left. But they had embalmed him, remember, and kept him. And so he had made his request that he be taken into the land when they go. He had his faith. And so Moses is sure to it that the coffin is taken along with him. And so they take Moses into the land and carried him around in the wilderness for 40 years. Or Joseph, I mean, yes. Carried him around in the wilderness for 40 years. That ought to have been a remembrance to them at that, just of faith and faithfulness. Just having Joseph's coffin with him. His remains, we call it. I'll read that 19th verse again. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straightly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones away hence with you. Joseph was absolutely sure that God was going to take Israel out of Egypt someday. And there was a promised land, and he wanted to have a part in it even though he was dead. His faith. Real faith. And they took their journey from Succoth, and encamped in Ethan, at the edge of the wilderness. Now we have it up here on the map, and we start the line over there to the left, the red line, from Ramesses, and then to Succoth, and then down to Ethan. So we have the three places there. I don't know whether the Lord had them to camp there or not. But it says, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light to go by day and night. So it was a dark cloud in the daytime they were to follow, and it was a light at night. And he took not away the pillar of the cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. Now there is one instance, however, that there was an exception to that. For one night that pillar of cloud and fire was followed after Israel. And in that instance, it was black, a cloud on one side, and as light on the other. I will get to that some of these times. That's in the story ahead. I'm just anticipating. So there was once when it followed them instead of going before them. Well, chapter 14. Quite an exciting story. You can't write fiction, you know, or come up with this. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and camp before by Hi-Haroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Zephon. Before it ye shall encamp by the sea. Now these places are on some of your good maps, if you happen to have some. I spoke a while ago of Migdol. That was a big fort. And that was at the end of the big wall that separated the north from the south there. Keep people coming from going to Egypt. Actually, the wall stretched from the north to the south instead of across the other way because they turned around the end of the Mediterranean Sea and started to go west to go to Egypt. And so the wall was across the way, and then that was continued by the Red Sea on south. That made a barrier too. Now, why is he telling them to encamp at Baal-Zephon? Or rather, by Hi-Haroth, between Migdol and over against or not far from Baal-Zephon. Well, he says here, for Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. Aha, we've got them, they'll say. Even with all of the plagues and so on, you find Egyptians still changing their mind, as they always have. And the Lord says, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that he shall follow after them. And I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. So they moved their camp. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled. And the heart of Pharaoh and of his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? And he made ready his chariot. He's going to go out and take his army and take care of his army in person. Not put some general in charge of it. Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, is going to go out and take charge of it in person. He's so mad because these Israelites are getting away from him. They're pretty valuable slaves, you know. Now remember, we said to the men, there's over 600,000. And even at a cheap price for a slave, that'd be worth a lot of money, wouldn't it? Well, the Egyptians don't like to lose something valuable any more than other people do. And here they've really lost a fortune. Now, I don't know how much a slave was worth in those days. I do remember that Judas sold the Lord for 30 pieces of silver, and that was about the worth of a slave or a servant, as some have told us anyhow. I don't know. And I don't know how much that was now, how many pounds and shillings that was. 30. Yes, it's the work that they were really missing. I might just add in that while we're thinking about it, that many years after this, see, this happened in 1491 B.C., and 70 years after the birth of Christ, or 70 A.D., we'll put it that way, be 74 years, that Titus destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and he took young men and young women out for it to sell for slaves. And the market was glutted until they couldn't even get a bid on most of them. They had just that many. Nobody wanted them. They just had too many. After all, if you got a bunch of slaves and don't have work for them to do, you got to feed them anyhow. So there's an economic twist to it, too. So probably back at this time, Egypt didn't have such a plentiful amount of slaves as they had almost 1,500 years later. Well, he made ready his chariot and took his people with him, and he took 600 chosen chariots, and all the chariots of Egypt, and captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with a high hand. They had taken wealth and so on with them. They really went out, you know, in good order. But the Egyptians pursued after them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, and his horsemen, and his army, and overtook them in camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal-Zephon. Catches up with them. Notice it doesn't say anything about foot soldiers here. This is all horsemen and chariots. So I don't know how many soldiers you had on horse. But it does give you something of the number of the chariots. 600 chosen chariots, and then all the chariots of Egypt. So these 600 were the best, and then there were others besides that. Now, usually a chariot had two in it at least. One to drive the chariot, and the other to do the dirty work, the fighting. Sometimes more. One could be on each side and fight from each side if they broke the enemy's ranks. So this would involve a lot of men. If there were 600 chariots, there probably were, possibly 1,200 men anyhow, if not more. And then there'd be other chariots and so on, besides all the horsemen. We don't know how many there were of those. Verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. And they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. They were really scared. They see all of that great army after them. And they didn't have any chariots. They didn't have any horsemen. But they did have armor and weapons. They were harnessed when they went up. Now, how and where they got those, I don't know. Whether that was among some of the jewelry that was pressed upon them and so on. And that word jewelry, of course, could cover a lot of territory, too. We have some stories in which there was, yes, part of armor was sometimes referred to significantly as being some jewelry. And they said unto Moses, of course he gets to be the whipping boy every time, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? How to carry is to take them out. He didn't pick them up and carry them. This was the old usage of the word carry. Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Wouldn't you like to be in Moses' place and have the folks come at you like that? And he was a very meek fellow. Just once, he let his temper get away with him. And that was at the very last, after the 40 years was over. And they pressed him a little too far. Of course, remember, at that time, he was 120 years old. What do you expect of a man 120 years old? They'd stood 40 years of their bad manners in the wilderness that God had stood too, and gotten along just fine. But that last time, he just let go. And of course, the Lord told him immediately, said that he would not get to enter the land, and he would not get to lead Israel into the land. Somebody else would get to do that. Verse 13. And Moses said unto the people, fear not, fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians, whom you have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. You think these Egyptians then are going to be resurrected sometime, like a lot of people claim? No, they'll be gone forever. So, Israel, God's resurrected people, will never see them. They'll never be there. See, those that don't believe have no part in the resurrection. And so they're told here they'd never see them anymore. I believe God meant what he said there. Verse 14, the Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace. In other words, while the Lord is fighting, why just keep still? Don't go to talking and carrying on or having anything to do with it and so on. Just stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And the Lord said unto Moses, wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward. But lift thou up thy rod, and stretch out thine hand over the sea, and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. And I will get me honor upon Pharaoh, and upon all his host, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. And you know, folks, that that is still God's purpose today, is to get the world to know that he is the Lord. That is the goal, and Israel is to be the messengers. As they were here, they were the ones who were set the example, and so on. And someday they will evangelize the nations. The Great Commission, given in Matthew 28:18-20, will be fulfilled in the millennium. And the people of the earth, all of them will get to know that he is Lord. Now, they won't all accept it any more than Pharaoh did. But they'll all get to know. And then, of course, when they know, then the responsibility is theirs. Well, we'll see what happens. And the angel of God, verse 19, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. Now here's what I told you about a while ago. And the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. And it was a cloud and darkness to them, that is, the Egyptians, but it gave light by night to these, the Israelites, so that the one came not near the other all the night. Get the picture? A great big headlight of some kind, where Israel spread all out so that around 3 million people could see. And on the other side of it, as black as pitch, and Egyptians couldn't see anything. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong cast east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. Well, I've seen the wind do a great deal to waters that way. I'm not surprised at it. I can remember in Toledo Bay, Lake Erie, that when the wind would blow in from the north, that funnel-shaped bay, it would pile the water up until it would even ruin some of the cottages that had big rocks and cement and so on for breakwaters. Just break right over that, wash some of it out, and ruin cottages. Raging place there. And then in the winter time, I've seen it when the wind blew out the other way and blew the water out, and the bottom of the bay was bare, and in cold weather that froze and people were driving out over there with their automobiles. Well, I've seen that much myself a number of years ago. So I can get a little bit of an idea maybe of what happened here. Now this Red Sea was not too awfully deep. Of course, now this place where I was speaking about these waves and so on, possibly not much more than 12 feet deep when it was its highest. But you can get some pretty good high waves with water being driven by the wind, even if it's only 12, maybe 15 feet deep. Well, we'll go on. There's a wall on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them to the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch, The Lord looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire, nor the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians. Began to stir up something, and took off their chariot wheels, that they drave them heavily. So that the Egyptians said, Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fighteth for them against the Egyptians. Well, we will wait until we get over into the next chapter before we tell you the secret of this. Just let that go for the time being. What did really happen? I've seen some of this too. I know what's talking about. Now, having had a little experience along some of these lines, having been a farm boy, why, I know something about these chariot wheels and breaking them off and the horses miring down and so on. Well, verse 26. And the Lord said unto Moses, Stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to his strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it, and the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Of course, when they saw that water starting to come, they began to run, but it was too late. It's too far to go. They couldn't make it. I might give this much explanation here, and I've spoken about that before, that if there was around 3 million Israelites here, they weren't going across a narrow defile through the sea of 25, 30, or maybe even 50 feet. It could have been up to 12 miles wide. You've got to have some space to get a great multitude of people like that across in a night. And you might sit down with your paper and pencil and figure out how fast people walk and how many abreast they'd have to be. And they were in order. They weren't in disorder. They went by fives in ranks and were harnessed. That is, the men had their arms. So it wasn't disorder. But nevertheless, they didn't waste any time. And they got across. All of them. In one night. Now, that's only just a few miles across there. It wasn't a long crossing. But they couldn't have done it without the waters being parted. It wasn't shallow enough to wade through by any means. Verse 28. And the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. A complete overthrow. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea. And if that is anything then like it is now, that would have had an awfully muddy bottom, and it would have been a hard thing to get across even if the water was blowing by. But it says they went across dry shod. There's a lot more miracle to this than we just see, you know, on the surface. Somehow, that mud was hardened so they could walk on it. And the waters are hardened and piled up on each side like a wall. Now, it indicates that the wind pushed them up into that position, and it became hard. You know what hard water is, don't you? We used to have that little joke, you know, spell hard water with three letters, I-C-E, ice. Maybe that was the answer. But at any rate, they went across dry shod. And the chariots broke through and tore the wheels off, and the horses mired down, and there was an awful mixture in there when the Egyptians got into it. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. They never saw him alive again. They did see some of the dead scattered. And Yeshua saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians. And the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. And yet, just a short time after this, they turned from Moses and turned from the Lord and worshiped a golden calf. How fickle a crowd can be. How fickle some Christians can be today. I have a little application on that too. You see some people who seem to have a mighty deliverance, who seem to believe, fear the Lord, have a testimony, and the first thing you know, they're done just like Israel. They have another God and forgotten the whole thing. Well, I don't think human nature's changed any since the time of Moses. In fact, I think many of our psychologists now would tell you that human nature hasn't changed in the last 6,000 years. Just the same as it was from the start. When you read about the very early ones in Genesis, you see there the same traits of character, the same mistakes that people make as they do now. One man getting angry and killing his brother. Another man having a desire to be great and so on, marries two wives. That's just right there in the first chapters of Genesis. And on and on. Well, in spite of all those failures and so on, Moses today is still a great person, and the scriptures speak of him. He was faithful, excepting that one incident, but he had done a great work. And so he was not put off the honor roll because of one mistake. Now the next chapter we go into next week is a song of Moses and the children of Israel. And we have a little song by Miriam in the chapter 2. So, and if you will look, I think you will find some of the account of this in the Psalms. That might be something interesting for you to try too. So now we will close this part of the lesson here for tonight and be ready for the next session in a few minutes. All right, we are ready to start with the next half of our evening's lesson. And let's turn to the first chapter of John's Gospel. John 1:14. I want to use that for my text to start with here, so maybe we better read the first 18 verses and then take that one out. How would that do? So let's read the first 18 verses of John, first chapter. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made.